Saunders, reel number 9.
Well, after we'd sent down the signal to the battery as to the result of his first shot, he corrected all his guns to suit that. We went down back again to the target and had another look, and then on our way back to the battery again, we gave him the signal to stand by again, ready to fire, and repeated this. And until eventually, we gradually got him to bring his shot right onto the target, or near enough the target to do a lot of damage. And as soon as that we got that, then we sent him the signal okay, and then he loaded all his guns at the same range and just poured as many shots as we thought necessary into it.
Did you employ any other systems of spotting for artillery while you were in France?
Yes, we got out what they call the zone system, which was a development of the artillery observation, which enabled us to bring in a greater number of guns on the target at a short notice.
Were any of these observation, any of this work observing for artillery, was it in any way unusual?
Well, yes, there was an unusual event. They built a little railway up to a place called Neuve-Eglise, and they brought up on the truck a 15-inch naval gun. I don't know what the target was, but it was a very long-distance one. And we were to observe, not me personally, but our squadron was to observe for it. The idea being that when it fired, the railway engine stood by and to whip it back in amongst the trees so that its position wouldn't be given away. Well, the first day we went up there, the aerial on the aircraft failed to work. It broke on its way as it was being released. The second day we went up, they couldn't find the target because there was fog over it. And I don't know what happened the third day, but they didn't bother any more about trying to fire that gun. They just took it back to wherever it came from. We didn't see it after that.
Now, I know that one of the other types of operation that Number 1 Squadron was involved in quite a lot was bombing operations. Did you have any association with those duties?
Well, I had actually no connection with dropping the bombs, but I had in fitting them up. And we made some light racks up that we could fit on the bottom of these Marans, on the bottom of the fuselage, with just by slipping four pins into position. And then we had a wire going round each bomb so that when this wire was pulled, the bomb dropped down. Well, we had to detonate these bombs and with fulminate of mercury detonators. When we got these, they came in a little box, half a dozen at a time, and they were wrapped up in cotton wool, and we had no instructions about them. So we got the bombs and we unscrewed the top, and when we wanted one of these, if the rigger was one side and I was the other and I wanted one, I'd just say, "Chuck us a detonator, Charlie," and he'd take it out and throw it at me and I'd catch it, or I'd do the same with him. Drop it in, then screw the top on the bomb, put it up in position. Now,
before you left France, were there any other particularly interesting operations with which you were involved?
Yes, there were three observation balloons just behind Ypres, which were giving our troops a lot of trouble, getting a lot of information.
These are German balloons?
German balloons, yes. And we decided that we'd go after them. So, because we'd previously got out some rockets, just like the firework rockets, which the kiddies play with, go a long way up in the sky. And we fitted some tubes on between the struts of the Newport machines we were going to send up with them, and connected, then slipped the rocket stem into this brass tube, these brass tubes. Then we had a battery in the cockpit, 4-volt battery, which was connected to these rockets. And when you switched on these rockets, it flew out. That flew out them. They came out in flames, of course. Well, we sent three aircraft up after these three balloons, one each. They hadn't got any guns or ammunition on them. And they were successful in bringing down the three balloons. And I was happened to be standing by in another, in a Morán, along with the pilot, waiting to go up to attack anything that might come after them. But fortunately, it began to rain, torrential rain, so we hadn't to go up. We didn't see any more of them. Next morning, we sent two of these aircraft down to Armentières, Armentières district, and they brought two more down. After that, the Germans got very cute. So instead of just winching the balloons down after that, they used to run the tractor a lot across the field as well. They got it down in half the time. And as soon as we saw a balloon up then behind Ypres, we only had to just send a machine up, and they disappeared immediately. There's one other little incident dealing with balloons which I'd almost forgotten. That was a balloon that was operating down beyond Armentières. And one day it broke away and it came floating along the line. Well, there were two Huns in it, and one jumped out in his parachute. They had parachutes in those balloons. But the other poor little fellow, he jumped and his harness got caught up. Well, the line, as it came up, it was drifting up towards us, the balloon, and as it came over the line zigzagged a lot. And when the balloon was over our side of the line, the Germans shelled it like hell. And when it went over their side of the line, we shelled it. But although several shells went through it, it didn't bring it down. Eventually, it was going over where we thought we wouldn't see any more of it. So one of the aircraft went up with incendiary bullets, and which were supposed to be illegal in those days, and set fire to it. And this balloon came down very, very gently, and this poor old little fat Hun hanging on with his harness, and as soon as they touched the ground, he undid his harness, and he ran like hell clear of it, and just got away as the balloon collapsed. Well, he wasn't very nice to Noah, to tell you the truth, because, hadn't got nice scent on him. And they took him into the officer's mess, not number one, but some other squadron higher up, and I believe they got some very useful information out of him.
Now, in October 1916, you left France and you were posted to Brooklands for flying training. Can we deal with this period in a general way? We could start off by asking you to describe what your recollections were of the kind of training you received at Brooklands.
Well, the kind of training we received at Brooklands, you were just taken up with the instructor, and the first few minutes he said, "Now don't you touch any controls, just put your hands on them lightly and your feet lightly on the bar, and just notice the amount of movement that is necessary to get the aircraft into the air and manoeuvre." And after about 5 minutes, he gradually let go of the controls and you just flew around as best you could, but of course holding the controls very lightly so that if anything happened he could correct them. And he just, in that particular aircraft, a Morris Farman, by throttling down the engine, he could shout and you could hear what he was saying. And he'd tell you, "Do this or do that," and then after about 25 minutes he'd say, "No, I'm coming into land," and just take particular note, and you just did that.
What did you take particular note of when he was coming into land?
Well, come a particular note of the angle of approach and the where he was aiming at on the aerodrome, and when to flatten out. And then you, if you thought you had that, that was all right. Then you went up again, and he supposed to have let you try and land the next time, but you didn't really know whether you were landing the aircraft or not, but you thought you were, but you got your distances and your angles correct anyway.
Now, how quickly was it before you personally went solo?
Well, I had two flights with him, one of 25 minutes and one of 20. But of course, I was in the exceptional position that I had done such a lot of flying as observer and gunner, and I also knew what the movements of the controls meant. What
was that happening. An exceptional position?
Yes.
I thought most observers, many observers, a large, very large number of observers went on to undergo flying training.
A lot of the observers, strange to say, when it came to actually handle the controls, they called it a day. They wouldn't do it. And then most people coming in at those days were coming straight out of civil life, and they didn't know one end of an aircraft and the other. But of course, I had all that experience behind me, and it came in very useful when I was actually learning to fly.
Now, after you had finished flying training at Croydon, where was your first appointment?
I was posted to Netherhaven with number 24 training squadron as an instructor. And there I was put in sea flights under Captain Blackwell.
Now, it seems rather odd to me, or unusual, should I say, that immediately after your own flying training, you should be instructing others when you'd had so little experience yourself.
Yes, well, of course, I've had a lot of experience of flying in France.
How much flying experience had you actually had at this point?
I'd had, I suppose, about 120 to 150 hours.
Now, when I say flying, I mean as a pilot.
As a pilot, I'd had about not more than about 20 hours.
20 hours flying.
Yes, but of course, in those days, pilots were known to have been sent out overseas after 12 hours flying. And 20 hours then was considered a fair amount.
Ah, a fair amount to be sent on active service, but it seems precious little to instruct other people.
Yes, but then I think they were short of instructors there at the time, because I found out afterwards that they'd had a couple of fatal accidents, and I was supposed to be just to make up the third.
But now, when you were posted to Netherhaven as an instructor, did you actually begin training pilots straight away, or was there any kind of further training for you before you started doing this work?
No, I was sent up by the Captain Blackwood, the flight commander of my flight, and he watched me very carefully for about half an hour, see how I was handling the machine, and when I landed he said, no, that's all right. And next morning he told me to take up a pupil and see what I could do with him. So I took him up, and pupils seemed to be very happy, and I think I was able to put it over to him in such a way, and after that things went swimmingly.
Now, you were to spend nearly the next 2 years, practically all of 1917 and all of 1918, as an instructor. Did you, during this period, come to develop your own methods for teaching your pupils?
Well, the first thing I did was to come down to their level, and I impressed it on them very much that flying wasn't at all difficult, and that they weren't to think that I was, or any other instructor, were supermen, because we weren't. We were only ordinary fellas, and I came down to their, made myself come down to their level of flying, and gradually worked them up, and I found that that was a much better way of doing it than to get them to look up to me as being a superman. I always explained to them, too, very definitely, that I didn't mind how many mistakes they made, that I wouldn't get worried, and they could make the mistake as often as they liked if they eventually got it correct. But I didn't want to, under any circumstances, for them to say, yes, that's all right, I've got that now, and then make a mistake the next time. And I found that this was very, very fine way of putting it over to them.
Could you tell me what aspects of flying your pupils tended to find most difficult?
Well, the most difficult one that they all found was landing. And when you brought them down, brought it down to earth, explained it all to them and let them see how easy it was to land an aircraft, it was just a question of speed coming down. Well, you could get that off your speedometer, and the angle of approach. And if you got the angle of approach correct, you could just let the aircraft land itself. And when you explained this to the pupils and demonstrated it to them, well, then they soon lost all fear of landings.
You said also that another problem they had was actually learning how to fly the airplane level. That surprises me. I thought that was pretty easy.
Well, I think it's natural for different people to be a bit heavy-handed at one hand or the other. And consequently, a number of people were inclined to fly with the right wing low or the left wing low. And as soon as you saw that, which they were doing, then you had to keep checking them on that until they realized it and corrected it. But there was no use in knocking them about or hammering them or anything like that. You just took it very casually. And as soon as you appeared to be casual in your work, well, then they eased up and they lost all tension, and there wasn't the slightest trouble after that in teaching them to fly correctly.